Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here today presenting my work with Steve Lamour at Yale University. In fact, this is not my first time working on this particular project. I've been working on this for last four years or so. I got my PhD from Dartmouth College working with a professor, Roberto Donofrio, who will be giving a talk at the end of November, probably, here at KIT. Today I'll be talking about my project with Steve Lamour here. So it all starts from a simple idea. As you may know, in free space, we have this zero-point energy of electromagnetic radiation, which is a continuous spectrum. And the problem gets a little bit more interesting once we put a physical boundary, two plates, for instance. And because of these boundary conditions, you restrict a number of modes available inside this little cavity. Okay, here's a nice graphic describing the Casimir force, how it's created. So you're looking at this energy difference between the free space and the energy available inside the cavity with that two physical boundaries, and you take the gradient of it, and now you get this very famous Casimir standard result. And this Casimir force is known as macroscopic effects of quantum electrodynamics. So think about this. You have a two big macroscopic physical body, and once you put these two physical bodies in free space, you create this attractive force. And this is distinct from the gravitational or electric normal electrostatic forces. So you've got this famous inverse square law from gravitational and electric forces, and you see that this the Casimir force is strongly distance dependent. So how about other forces apart from strong and weak forces? So we can speak of van der Waals force. Thurston gave a nice overview of this whole genre of molecular forces yesterday. So in literature, you will find three different kinds of van der Waals force. You have Keesom and Debye and London. And probably London force is one of the most interesting forces because you're dealing with this induced force between two neutral atoms or molecules. So let's take a simple example here. You have two helium atoms, noble gases. And momentarily, instantaneously, these electrons also see the nucleus of the other atoms. And you could actually have this attractive force between these two apparently neutral atoms. So the two neutral atoms attract each other. And in one case, you have a London's typical 1 over R6. It's a purely quantum mechanical force, in a sense that you're considering the fluctuation coming from these charge sources in the atoms. And you can also extend your computation to by considering the fact that the speed of light is finite, and you have this retarded Casimir polar force. So we have time for one quick question. Could the Casimir force somehow be related with van der Waals force? So here is an alternative perspective on the Casimir force. Okay, so we take a standard two plates facing each other. It's a metallic plate. And you take a snapshot of the metallic plate, and you realize that there are all these neutral atoms, possibly dipoles induced, and they could attract each other. So here is an alternative. Here is a one way to look at the problem. On one hand, we have a Casimir force as the consequence of zero-point energy of electromagnetic fields in a vacuum space. On the other hand, we have the van der Waals force as the consequence of dipole interaction of these neutral molecules. So it's a two different perspective. It's a two different ways to look at the same problem. So in between, we can actually go back to the original physical statements by this Russian physicist. And you see that there is a problem of source of the radiation. Okay, so we already see the link here of the process which takes place in a molecular vibrator when it radiates light energy into space. Okay, so we already see the link between this Casimir energy, whose main focus is on this field in free space where the two boundaries are restricting the number of modes available On the other hand, you have this, the source of radiation due to these dipoles. So here is, an alternative formalism by Lipschitz. Okay? So you take the famous Maxwell's equation here. Okay? So it's like a let there be light, but you can have a let there be force by adding this extra term of a fluctuation source. Okay? So when you do that, you go over this heavy-duty map, and you just take the same physical boundaries, where now the epsilon is not, it's something very general. You're not considering anything ideal, like a Casimir calculation. So you go through this Lipschitz formalism, and at the end of the day, you take this epsilon to go infinite, meaning that you're dealing with this perfect metallic plates, and you arrive to the famous Casimir force. And you smile. And in 1978, the Lipschitz formula has been rederived independently by Schrödinger, Dillard, and Milton based on the source theory. So here is something to ponder.
Excuse me, could you go one slide back?
Yes.
In the large parentheses, you have two equal terms, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think it's a typo. You want to have the other one is different.
Oh yes, I think yeah. I probably missed. Yeah, it's a combination of P and TM modes. Yeah, yeah. But you know what I'm talking about. It's a Lipschitz formalism where I think you can find this standard result from Milani or any other textbook.
It's a copy paste phenomenon.
Yes. All right. Here is something to ponder. Is the Casimir force the same as the van der Waals force? Okay. What is so special about zero-point energy of quantum vacuum? You see, in understanding the van der Waals force, we didn't have to invoke the idea of zero-point energy. You can always go back to your boundary condition or actual physical boundaries, and in it, you have to deal with all these neutral molecules that are dancing and inducing all these dipoles. So here is a link that I can provide to understand this problem better. You can think of this in terms of fluctuation dissipation theorem. So take a simple harmonic oscillator where you have a driving term with an electric field, and you have some you can separate this electric field into two terms. One is the average electric field, and the other one is radiation reaction term due to the dipole fluctuations. And you realize that this radiation reaction term is nothing but dissipation source. So on one hand, you have a fluctuation. On the other hand, you have a dissipation due to this radiation reaction. So here is what I have. It's a very personal opinion on this subject, but this is the way I think about the Casimir force. The moment we speak of the Casimir force, immediately we implicitly imply that there is this set of physical boundary. You cannot avoid the fact that you have these physical boundaries. And once you have the physical boundaries, then you have to deal with this dissipation associated with radiation processes of neutral molecules that constitutes the boundaries.
What about topological situations when you have a circle, when there are no boundaries?
What's the situation again?
Imagine you have, your boundary is, a field is defined on the circle, and so there is no boundary. So the only condition is some condition of periodicity.
But, in any realistic physical problem, I cannot think of any system that has not a particular boundary. When you do an experiment, when you look at a problem of molecular force, necessarily you're looking at a two set of boundary conditions. And you cannot avoid the fact that there are no boundaries such that you are really probing this zero-point energy in the free space. So in my opinion, this is a very realistic point of view. When you do an experiment, there is no set of... You have to have a boundaries. The fact that you're talking about the Casimir force, you're implying that there is a physical set of physical boundaries.
Less
happy with the dissipation, because that seems to me to sound like there's energy loss. Personally, you just mean fluctuations of the sources.
I guess once you have a fluctuation, once you have a fluctuation, I think the dissipation is part of that whole picture. I mean, that's how I understand the fluctuation dissipation theorem. So you cannot have one without the other. It's in a way it's a complementary picture of this whole dipole-dipole interaction.
This retardation effect is really, it's an approximation. In principle, I think if you try to do it classically, it will never end. This equation will have more terms.
Right,
it's
right.
It's really not the solution of the retardation effect.
Yeah, you not only have a dipole, but you can expand your calculation to quadrupoles and you know, all other terms. And in fact, in any given experiment, we always separate between monopoles, which is electrostatic energy, electrostatic force, and the rest of the interaction, which we regard them as Casimir or van der Waals force type. Yeah. So before, yeah.
But I mean, Bob Jaffe criticized about this Casimir calculations that basically it resembles the static Coulomb problem, where you could treat the problem two ways, either as you have surface charges on these obstacles, and you have everything is coming from the surface charges, or from a field in between. You have to go to the dynamical situation, where you change something to say whether the force is carried by the field or the force is carried by the surface. And so if you, for instance, would change something, and then you could probably check out whether the force is in the field fluctuations, or is linked to the surfaces. Because, you have to satisfy Lorentz invariance.
Just maybe a comment. In statistical mechanics, not in such an extreme quantum regime, when people talk about black box radiation, so on one hand, they know, since the radiation is equilibrium, they know the distribution. On the other hand, it is clear that this radiation in the black box was created by atoms at the boundaries,
right,
which also are at the same temperature. And therefore, it actually somehow it's guaranteed that this thing must close, that they will radiate exactly to create exactly this thing.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
Probably something must also exist here, somehow, some kind of closure that they will radiate exactly what is needed to keep it, but I just don't know how.
Yeah,
that.
I mean, one example is the fact that the Casimir results, which looking at that field of the zero point in radiation, renders exactly the same results as the Lipschitz formalism, which looking at the source of that radiation, basically you're getting the same results, but it's a different way to looking at the same problem. But my point is that the moment Casimir is some kind of fancy word to me, because once you speak of the Casimir force, you don't really talk about these boundaries, but you rather concentrate on this zero point notion of the quantum vacuum. And once you do that, then it could be quite misleading, because eventually you are dealing with this clear physical boundaries, and that's where the force is coming from, in a sense.
The question you ask is how this zero point energy depends on the boundaries, and that's the way Casimir did it. So the boundaries play a role, even with the example of black body radiation. Black body radiation has radiation pressure.
Exactly.
Which is simply the volume dependence of the energy.
Right. So I mean, you can't do any Casimir force. You don't have any Casimir force without any physical boundaries.
I think he's saying something else. He's saying, I mean, in general, you have to worry about material properties. That's what you're doing if you're applying Lipschitz theory.
Sure.
And then in a given limit, you can, of course, recover the Casimir force with a universal answer. But, I mean, whether, under what conditions you see that, it has to be investigated. You have to have a concrete experimental situation in mind, and then you have to rethink the ideal assumptions of a perfect conductor and things like that.
Yeah.
do I understand this correctly? I mean, when you, Meron asked about dissipation, so I mean, you're referring with this to Lipschitz theory, you basically do rotation to imaginary frequencies, and then if you, what you need is just the dielectric response of the material on the imaginary axis, and that's completely determined by the imaginary part of the dielectric function on the real axis.
On the real axis. Yeah.
So that's, and that's connected to dissipation. That's,
right.
That's what you're referring to here?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, yeah. I mean, you're looking at that material response to the optical studies. So, okay, before we getting into all these philosophical issues, let me move on, and I'll talk about the actual experiment at Yale. So it's a torsion balance. So you have here, it's a top view, you have a torsion balance body here, it's a pivot point here, so it's tilting this way, like this. I'll explain that more clearly. So it's an upgrade from Steve Lamoureux's 1997 original experiment. We are using a shorter wire length, and it's improved vacuum and vibration isolation. So it's improved version of his original experiment. So any imbalance in capacitance, so there is a compensator plate here. So suppose that there you apply some force on the Casimir plate size here. Any imbalance in capacitance will be read by these AC bridges, and it will be amplified through a phase-sensitive detector, and this puts out some error signal to the PID controller. And this PID controller, reading that error signal, provides correction voltages, which restores the torsion balance here. So the correction voltage that PID controller puts out is exactly the proportional. It's proportional to the force you apply on the Casimir plate size. So this is our key experimental parameter. We read out this PID signal, which is the correction voltage to the force you applied. So the PID is a proportional integrator differential gain controller. So what it does is, depending on how much error signal you get, it also spits out whether you can have a negative or positive feedback. But what it does is, it based on that error signal created by this AC bridge circuits, it puts out some correction voltages and restores the balance equilibrium. So this is the key parameters in our experimental setup. The force signal is proportional to the PID signal that we read. Just for your information, we use a germanium plate facing each other. The radius of curvature is 15 centimeters. And compared to the silicon has a very high resistivity. It's almost 3 orders of magnitude larger. So germanium is, in a sense, accessible for experimental work because of the low resistivity, you can actually calibrate the system by applying some electrostatic force. So here is the actual experiment. Entire setup is inside this whole vacuum. So you're looking at the Casimir plate size here, and there is a compensator plate here. So picture is taken by Professor Steve Lamoureux. So here is the acquisition of our experimental data. Remember, we had this PID signal, which is directly proportional to the force that we measure on the Casimir plate size. And now I'm applying some voltages. This voltage is put out on the Casimir plates. So the more voltages I put on the Casimir side, you'll read more signal on the PID. So on some 0 volts, I apply some 0 volts, around the zero, not necessarily exactly zero, and you read out some PID signal, you increase the voltages, more force, so you get more signal out of it. Of course, goes increasing. And on the other side, notice that this electrostatic force, which is proportional to the voltage, is always attractive. So it's looking like this on the other side, and looks like a parabola, and we fit with a parabola curve. And now this is a particular distance. At a particular distance, you have some parabola curvature. But as I get closer, you would expect that electrostatic force is increasing. Yeah. And I get closer, the electrostatic force is increasing. And notice that the force is proportional to the V squared here. And not only that, and that's the one information we can get, this parabola curvature. And another thing is that we notice that this voltage, it's not necessarily at zero. Okay, there is always some residual volts you have to put out in order to minimize your potential. Okay, so in an ideal situation, the minimizing potential should lie all at zero. But in reality, you have to put some contact potential in order to minimize your potential. Okay, and another observation we can make is that.
What is the source of that?
So in a real experiment, when you want to minimize electrostatic force, you put, like I say, 0 volts between the plates, then you don't get any, you should not get any forces. But in reality, there is some nominal amount of voltages you have to put out in order to minimize the electrostatic force. So suppose that I fit this parabola and I don't get exactly V equals zero. I get something like 3 millivolts. And that 3 millivolts correspond to some kind of minimizing potential that I can get out of this parabola curvature.
That's the source of that residual charge.
That's a very good question. I don't know. We are dealing with some electric network of the system, and sometimes obviously you don't expect this residual potential to be exactly zero. There is some nominal amount of offset we have to apply, but this is becoming very, very important because we have noticed that this voltage that we put out, the contact potential, is not constant with respect to distance. It could also change with respect to distance, and that could create that could actually propagate some systematic error in the final analysis.
But for the Casimir force, you always look at the minimum.
Exactly. So here, the reason why we do this parabola measurement is because we want to get the electrostatic minimum. So this minimum is the signal. Actually, it's increasing here. And that we can call as a Casimir. So the electrostatic force, which is proportional to the voltage square, and we get the minimizing potential, and parabola curvature, and this S naught, which is the minima of the curve, corresponds to it. Also, it contains some kind of non-electrostatic forces. So in it, we have a DC signal of this PID signal. So the PID signal is not always zero at large distance. It has some nominal value when you move out. So it's some experimental parameter that we had to figure out at large distance. And other than that, we have some Casimir contribution, hopefully, and some other forces that we have to identify. Is this clear?
Yeah. I see purple, red, and green.
So when you said there's an offset from the zero, that is to say there's an electric field at the place where you're measuring the minimum. I'm not clear what the source of the error is here that you're talking about. Ideally, I'm missing something about this minimum. It's the sharpness of the minimum, and it's also the location of it, and I'm missing something here in terms of what is an error and what's a measurement. This shift to the right, is that...
Yeah, these are not actual data points.
We can only hope for such nice points.
Is it reproducible at all?
It's a reproducible.
Static charge.
So suppose that, let's forget about contact potential changing with respect to distance. Yeah. So in an ideal measurement, you would expect that all the minima will line up at zero. 0 volts, no electrostatic force. Is it clear? So now we need actually extra parameter here, which is Vm, because this minima is not necessarily zero. In a real experimental situation, you have to put out some voltages to counterbias this residual electrostatic force. So in reality, it's slightly shifted.
So the residual electrostatic force, I'm not sure where these electrostatics are between the two objects you're measuring.
Exactly.
So the field in there could be non-trivial if you're at a short distance, or is it not?
Yes. I'll get to that point, because in short distance, there is a striking observation that these contact potentials are changing with respect to distance.
Right.
So I'll get to that point. But for now, this minimum is not necessarily zero, but it could have some offset due to the fact that you have all these wires connecting with each other, and I mean, this is a real experimental problem. I mean,
you only got it as a kind of stray effect.
Yeah, stray potential. Some
maybe some charges that clicked into the lens.
Sure. So if I didn't do this, if I suppose that I do a Casimir force measurement, just putting out 0 volts, and I can just move the plate all the way to contact. I mean, I can still do similar measurements here. I can get some residual, apparently all these minima, but we're not going to get exact values because it will be just some offset here. So we may collect all these points that contains this extra electric field force.
But the plate and the sphere are made out of the same material, right?
It's a germanium, pure germanium, yes.
Yeah. And you have cleaned it before or something
like that? Oh, yeah. I mean, this is very, yeah, we took a lot of care maintaining the cleanness of the plates. And notice that all Casimir force measurements, if you read those papers, they report some large contact potential measurements. At large distance, you know, typically you can probably expect 100 millivolts down to 3-4 millivolts range.
This would mainly have surface states?
I think so. But for now, I don't think it's a big deal in terms of we get this offset of contact potential. It's more interesting if this contact potential change with respect to distance, because that really tells you what's going on between the surface states. Because you can suppose that I go walk back to my apparatus, I change some wires, I change with some, you know, copper wires to gold wires. The way it makes contact, all the geometry, the way it's soldered, it could also affect the offset of the contact potential. And I don't think that's very important, that's very crucial. What's interesting is how this contact potential could change with respect to distance. And that's more intrinsic to the system that we are trying to consider.
And the temperature is always room temperature.
At room temperature, exactly. Okay, so data analysis. So what I'm going to do is go over each parabola parameters one by one. So I introduced the three parameters, parabola parameters. One is the minima of the curve, and the other is the K. K tells you how large this curvature is. So as you see, as we get closer and closer, this curvature is getting narrow and narrow because you are getting closer to the plates. And there is extra parameter, which is Vm, the contact potential for now, but I'm going to call that as minimizing potential. Okay, so let's go over this K value, the coefficients first.
I have a question.
Yes.
In this problem, you are assuming somehow that the surfaces of the plates, if they are plane parallel, let's say, are equipotential, no? But in fact, the field due to residual charges may have something like patch effect.
Yes, yes.
So there would be a dependence on the distance then.
Yes, yes.
The offset potential.
So, yeah, we'll get to that.
It's not uniform, I mean, the residual electric field.
Exactly. But for now, we are just doing some kind of average measurements. And I'll get to that part.
Is this the origin of the separation dependence?
We have no idea. I mean, this is very conspicuous in our observation, and we haven't really understood what's really going on, and that's why I'm here and try to understand these measurements. And
as far as the facts, if you repeat the experiment with another sample, these offset voltages will be the same?
No, very different. I'll show you the some values.
If you take the same sample and repeat the experiment after 5 minutes.
That's a good question. So there is a long-term drift, but as you will see in our data, it's the long-term drift is kind is very minimal. You will see, but there is a clear trend with respect to distance. I'll show you the plots. So for now, I'm going to concentrate this K value, the K value, which tells you the parabola curvature. So as you saw, as we get closer, I have some points at some large distance, and I'm getting closer to the plates here.
DR is the distance between the plates. How do you measure it?
Okay. So DR, it's not the D that I wrote before. This DR is the relative distance. And this is very important because this is why I'm calling electrostatic calibration. In the electrostatic calibration, you have to calibrate your system. You have to know the absolute distance. This is the crucial juncture of any experimental work on these force measurements, because when you move your actuator, you don't actually register the absolute distance. You only know the relative distance. Suppose that you have a PZT. you don't immediately know where you are in terms of distance. You only know how much voltage you put on your piezoelectric actuator. So the information you have, information available to an experimenter, is the only the relative distance at this point. Okay? So this is why this is important to analyze this K, as you will see. And at some relative distance, I get some K values. As I get closer, you see this is increasing. And this is some distance. As I get closer, it's now reaching an asymptotic limit. It's closer. And at that last point, you may get in contact or not. But you will see there is a clear asymptotic limit. And this D naught, which I'm going to call, will tell you the distance between the plates. You know the relative distance, and now you know where this asymptotic limit lies from this curvature measurement. Is it clear?
It's K?
The K is the parabola curvature. I'm talking about this parabola curvature. So when you fit your parabola at given distance, you'll have some numbers, the K curvature value. And as you get closer, this K vector, it's not a vector, its value is increasing, reaching to an asymptotic limit. So this is what I'm doing here. So that asymptotic limit is its D naught. And this D naught enables us to calculate the absolute distance. And not only that, this, in analyzing this K value, we can also get a calibration factor of the system. Notice that we don't measure the force looking at the PID signal. It's actually the voltage that we measure. So you have to calibrate from voltage unit to the actual Newton. So in doing so, we have to use this electrostatic formula, which came from this the V square formula that you saw in the previous slides. And I put another parameter called the beta. And this beta is our calibration factor. It tells us how much voltage is corresponding to the actual force. Okay? So this calibration procedure is crucial for us because it enables us to evaluate two crucial parameters in experiments. One is the calibration factor, beta, and the other one is the absolute distance. So from these measurements, we know the calibration factor and the absolute distance. Yes?
So is K proportional to the capacitance between?
That's a very good question. Yes, indeed. In fact, this is the derivative of the capacitance. I'll get back to that point. Yeah, it's very important. Okay? Yes?
How big are the plates? Did you say that you make sure they are parallel? Because then the capacitance will be different.
Yeah. That's a very good point. Yeah, so we do have an XYZ stage, and then we make sure that the plates are in parallel. And this is a sphere plane geometry, so it's not as difficult as doing a parallel plane geometry. And it's about 1 inch diameter, and then the radius of curvature is about 15 centimeter. So when you look at the plates, it's almost flat. You don't see much of the curvature on it. So the electrostatic calibration, we got two information, calibration factor and absolute distance. And notice that you can actually get this distance information from asymptotic limit, or you just arrange the curvature and the alpha, which contains all these parameters, including calibration factor. You can also measure the distance from this alpha, the other parameter. And you notice that these two parameters are not necessarily independent to each other. So when you do an experiment, you have to be very careful because the calibration factor and absolute distance are necessarily related to each other with your fitting procedure, because those fitting procedure has to render the same values of distances. No matter which value you use, you have to get the same distance information from the same system. So those two parameters, apparently they look different, but they are interconnected. And this is very, and this allows me to discuss this 1 over d power law of the inverse. It's basically coming from the inverse square law. The fact that we rely the inverse square law of the Coulomb's electrostatic measurements in order to do this kind of calibration, it's very crucial that we have a very good 1 over d dependence in our system. Otherwise, all this calibration procedure will break down.
So
So this 1 over d comes from applying kind of proximity of
proximity. Exactly, yes. It's coming from basically you apply the Coulomb's 1 over d squared to the plates and you do a capacitance calculation and you just get the standard electrostatic force of v squared over d. Okay, so moving on to the next parameter, which is the contact potential or minimizing potential. And as you see, I'm getting all these three parameters at given distance. Okay, so at each distance, I have three information, k, and I also have a v, m, which is minimizing potential, and the minima of that curve. Okay, so I'm going to looking at this v, m more carefully for the moment. And you realize that this is actually kind of problematic because in all previous Casimir force measurements, this Vm has been assumed to be a constant with respect to distance. Okay, so what you do is you measure this minimizing potential at large distance and you apply the potential and then you move the plates all the way to contact. But in reality, this could change. Okay, this could change with respect to distances. And one way to look at this problem is that let's go back to the electrostatic energy of the plates, the two plates. And what we do is we actually take the gradient of this electrostatic energy, and you get the following formula. Suppose that this contact potential changes, then you would have to take another derivative here. But if the contact potential doesn't change, you are safe. You can just use the standard result, the derivative of capacitance as a curvature, and the Vc is simply equal to the Vm that we measure. But this is true. The minimizing potential is equal to the contact potential only if the contact potential doesn't change. Okay? If this changes, then your minima is not necessarily the same as the contact potential. And I'll show you that here. So now, suppose that your contact potential is changing, and now your minima has an additional term here due to that change in contact potential. So in an ideal situation where contact potential doesn't change, you're minimizing, the minima of your parabola is the same as the contact potential of that measurement. But in reality, this could also vary, and you have an extra term. And not only that...
Yes,
please ask me questions. Yes.
Stupid question. Yes. How do you find contact potential?
Ah, that's a very good question. I'll get to that point because for now, suppose that the contact potential hadn't changed, then we can just say that our measured minimizing potential is simply the same as the contact potential. But in this case, we have to do another calculation to actually get the Vc. In order to get the Vc, you have to solve this first order differential equation.
So the contact potential now a theoretical concept in the moment?
In a way, it's a theoretical concept now.
Okay.
It's contact without contact.
Yes, contact without contact. And notice that this Vm, the minimizing potential, is the only information we get from our measurements. And if Vc doesn't change, it's okay. You're safe. You don't have to go through all this math again, but you have to solve this differential equation if this contact potential changes. And you see that there is another term coming from this contact potential changes, which means that your electric static force has another term associated with this contact potential. And this is very important because this could be a source of systematic error in the actual Casimir force measurements. If your Vc doesn't change, then you can ignore this extra term, but if that changes, then your minima also contains this residual term. So now the question is, we not only have to deal with this, the fact that this contact potential changes, but also we have to deal with this extra term in our minima of the in our minima data. And notice that this is independent of voltage we apply, and could be a source of systematic error and must be searched in our minima parabola minima. So now let's move on to the third parameter, which is this S naught. Okay, so that's the minima of the curve. And now we know that this also contains this residual electrostatic force. And now I can write the distance axis here as an absolute distance because I have already calibrated my system. So I have D naught minus DR, which is my absolute distance. And notice that I can also have this axis. Without putting SPID, I can now put the actual force because now I know the calibration factor. So I just collect all these minima of the parabola, and you see the force is increasing. And that's just converting my PID signal to the force, and you collect all these points here. Okay? And these are supposedly a combination of electrostatic residual and possibly some Casimir force that we are searching for.
Sorry, just to understand, is this equivalent to the problem of patch potentials in the case of metallic plates? I mean, they give rise to a residual electrostatic force that you cannot eliminate by an offset potential.
Yeah, I think so.
It's the same thing phrased in a different way.
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the electric field is not homogeneous.
So this, yes, I think that's very clear because you see that this is independent. This residual term is independent of the voltage we apply.
Yeah. You cannot eliminate it.
You cannot eliminate it.
Yeah. So it is the same as the patch potential business in metallic.
Yeah. System. But I don't know exactly how I could describe this in terms of patch potential. But I mean, clearly.
No, what I mean is that it's a result of the anomaly of the electric field existing between the plates, the residual electrostatic field between the plates, which you can model as an effective distance-dependent contact potential.
Right.
But it's really the inhomogeneity of the field, which I don't know.
Right, right.
In this sense, it's analogous, it seems to me, to the patch potential case.
Yeah.
Because patches give rise to inhomogeneity, no? In the electric field.
Yeah, this has to be understood. I don't have a good feel about the connection. Yeah, yeah. So, is this clear? I think so far I've described our experimental procedure, how to get to these measurements, doing all this calibration and et cetera.
It's true that there were analogous claims by, well, you were in this group, so you know, by Roberto Noff.
Yeah, I was in the group. Yeah.
You were there.
Yeah. Okay, so now real measurements. Okay, so this is a single sweep measurement of our apparatus. You see that this is a parabola at one distance. We're getting closer, so the parabola is just slightly upshifted. And then the parabola curvature is clearly increasing. Okay, so this is a single measurement. And now I'm collecting all this parabola curvature. This is a K that you saw. And this K value is increasing, reaching an asymptotic limit. And I'm only showing three of them here. But for given experimental sweep, I'm collecting more than 30 to 35 parabola curvature. But for clarity, I'm just showing three of them here. So while I'm collecting those, I can also collect the minimizing potential. And as you see, there's a clear trend of increases. And notice that the degree of change is less than 5 millivolts here. It's a small effect that we see. Okay? So not only that, we also get the minima of the parabola curve. And you see, you already see this rise of the parabola curve here. Okay? So this is a one single sweep of the actual experiment. So in terms of statistics, we do a parabola measurement all the way to contact. It's a single sweep, typically acquiring 25 to 30 parabola measurements, acquiring 3 parabola parameters at each distance, from 100 micron down to 500 nanometer. Okay? Each parabola measurement takes about 5 minutes with 5 different applied voltages, and it takes about 2 hours for complete sweep. And we do these measurements for 3 weeks, 20 days, nonstop, with a total of 193 sweeps. So you do a parabola measurement all the way to contact, you retract, and you repeat that again 193 times, back and forth. Okay? So we take about 5,900 data points. Those are the parabola minima of the force curve. And we repeat this procedure for different lateral positions and reproduce the same force curve. And we have about 10 piconewton resolution. Okay.
What limits in each at each parabola? How many voltages you take? Why does it take so long?
I mean, we can obviously we can only take a 3 voltage. We can put out 3 voltages and get parabola as well, but we're getting five data points at each parabola for each parabola measurements, and you have to wait until the system finds its equilibrium. Remember, we have a
takes an hour between two measurements here.
Takes about 2 hours between the one complete sweep to another. So you do a parabola measurement all the way contact, and then when you retract, it takes about 2 hours. That whole measurement.
But at a given distance, you're just changing voltage,
right?
Because of the feedback and all of that, it takes time.
Oh yeah. You have to wait until the system finds equilibrium, because once you put out some different voltages, the PID will jump, and then it will find its equilibrium at that point. So it takes a finite amount of time to restore the torsion balance equilibrium. It's an experimental issue, and we want to go a little faster, but this is best we can do. We can probably go a little faster, but then we may suffer some statistical error.
The D0 is in the order of 500 nanometers? Or?
Say again?
The D0, parameter D0.
So this is evaluated based on D0 minus DR. So, yeah, that's the absolute distance now I'm talking about. Yeah. So if you talk about the relative distance, I mean, it doesn't make any sense, because the relative distance we put here is in millimeter, and also this is some arbitrary units. These are DR. But once I put the asymptotic limit here, I know where absolute distance is. And that absolute distance is the one I'm reporting.
And
here.
Why is T0 5? I mean, do you have an idea why is this caused? There are hills on the surfaces, or why it's 500 nanometers?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. We're getting really close, and sometimes the PID controller goes out of loop. And the fact that you are so close to the plates probably tells us that it's either in a non-linear regime that we can't really do a linear correction to the plates, or it's just that it's just so close for us. It's a macroscopic lens, and down to 500 nanometer is very close distance. Okay, so actual measurements, this is parabola curvature, relative distance, and you're looking at that K here. And as you see, we see some kind of drift over 3 weeks. And there is a drift about 5 microns over 3 weeks. But this is not a big deal for us, because what we do is actually, once we complete the sweep, we do an electrostatic fit, and we don't have to wait for 3 weeks to acquire the asymptotic limits. So we're looking at only the single sweep, and a single sweep suffers about 20 nanometer drift. And this is about less than 5% at the closest approach. So this is not a big issue for us. The average chi-square, again, this is based on the 1 over d fit of the parabola curvature, is about 1.2. And the Paolo exponent, when I took that as a free parameter, I get about 0.9979. It's a very, so in a sense that this test is the test of the Coulomb's force law. And this will give us the bound, the upper bound of the precision on the Casimir force measurements. And this is actually interesting, the way I got this number. So, but it's a kind of complicated, and I don't want to get into details. I'll be happy to discuss this procedure, because I'm...
Just want to make sure it's the power of. This is the power and the force of the function of separation? Which...
Yes, so when you have this, collect these K values, you have a 1 over D characteristic, right?
Right, yeah. Which is, I guess, what you're supposed to have.
For yeah, you should, yeah, but I don't assume this 1 over D. I leave that exponent as a free parameter and looking at how reliable that is. And this is the average of 193 sweeps. Okay, so minimizing potential. To see the clear trend here, had I measured the minimizing potential at large distance, I would have concluded that this is not really changing. But the fact that I did this parabola measurement all the way to contact, I'm already seeing this clear effects of changing of the contact potential with respect to distance. And this is very repeatable. And the offset could change with respect to time. Somebody was asking about the drift. This is 3 weeks of drift, but that it is clear that we have a slope characteristic of this contact potential. And now the residual force. So these are the minima of the parabola curve after acquiring 5,900 data points. And remember, we have to do some massage on this data because we noticed that because the contact potential changes, we have to deal with this residual term. Okay? So each point represents the minima of a single parabola measurement. So in a sense, each point here is an average of five data points, because when you do a parabola measurement, you take about five data points there. And the PID signals are monitored before and after. Remember, if the PID signal also drifts, then your force measurements are affected. So what I do is, after each complete sweep, I monitor the PID signal and make sure that there was no drift. If there was any drift, then I do a linear correction. And it's all, it's normally less than 10 piconewton over 100 micrometer. Okay, so the computing contact potential. This is a preliminary analysis. Okay, so these are the data points from the actual measurements. And I just guess some contact potential. In this case, I guess that it's behaving logarithmically. Okay? So when I have this, I reproduce this blue curve here, which fits with data pretty well. Notice that there are some disagreements here and disagreements there. But it's okay, because what I try to do here is to see how much this residual affects our measurements. Okay? I just want to see the rough idea how much it's affecting. So in reality, you have to be careful, because eventually, once you get this minimizing potential, you have to solve this differential equation to get the complete picture. But sometimes the numerics is not very stable, so you get all kinds of different answers. But for now, I get a pretty good estimate how much this residual force contributes. Okay, so let's go back to our residual force data. And this is, these are the average of our force data. And the green line is based on that residual term. Okay? So that's the residual electric force. You see that it's pretty large. It's something that we cannot ignore. And the fact that the contact potential was changing very small amount, it's less than 10 millivolts, we get a huge correction due to that change. And this is actually contained in the residual force of the Casimir signal. Okay, well, we have some experimental data to work with now, because you want to compare with the actual theory. Typically, you just go to Lipschitz formalism and just go through all these calculations. And once I get the optical data from somewhere, technically, I should take my samples out and then do an actual measurement, but I didn't do that. I was actually getting all these measurements, optical data from Pellick, and I'm just trying to do a calculation here. One thing that I have to emphasize here is that there are two distinct models in the Casimir communities. One is plasma model, and the other one is a Drude model. In the Drude model approach, you take the metal as a real metal, in a sense that the real metal does not obtain any contribution from the n equals zero part of the transverse electromagnetic mode. So you have that model, and then you also have a plasma model, which goes which includes this zero contribution, the n equals zero part of the TE mode. Okay, so you have a two different, you will see the two different calculations. So these are the actual data after correcting that residual electrostatic force, and these are the two curves from the theoretical measurement, theoretical predictions. And one thing we have to notice is that we are getting this huge 1 over D-like force in the large distance. Remember, we never started our measurements at few microns as other previous measurements have done. We actually started our measurements down to 100 micrometer.
How are you doing the calculation?
Us, yeah. So
you're keeping finite temperature all the time.
Yep, finite temperature.
But you're at fairly long distances, right? So that you're retarding out a huge amount of contribution.
Right. So yeah, you have a TE and TM modes. So this is the dielectric function on the imaginary axis. I get the imaginary part of the dielectric function from the Pellick. I use a Cramer's chronic relation to calculate that, and I supply these values here.
All this stuff.
Yeah.
distances. You're at such long distances that you're really you're getting most of your contribution from fairly low frequency terms, I guess. Right?
100 microns. So yeah, I mean it's. I think at room temperature we're talking about 6-7 micron. So.
Yeah.
100 micron, I don't know how much that corresponds to in terms of electron volts. But that's actually a good point. I don't know, because maybe that's why I don't have a good measurement, predictive values here, but this is...
The system seems to be wanting to tell you I'm doing something different over here,
yeah.
And then I'm doing what you think I'm doing.
Because these are the data. I mean, I don't think Pellick has data beyond those range. So
well, those are such limited data that it's almost like it's a shame to work so hard.
I know. Yes. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. But one clear
better than the data probably.
One clear feature here is that we have this slow rise of the force curve. And remember, had I started our measurements a few micron, as other force measurements have done, I would have rescaled my zero and then bring it down so that it would have looked closer to the actual measurements. But we didn't do that. We wanted to make sure that we have a good definition of the DC power of our PID signal. And that's why we went so far. And accidentally, we found this slow rise of the force towards the plate.
So if I understand correctly, the difference between A and B case is whether you include the N equals zero term or not.
Exactly. That's the only difference. Yeah. There is something called the Debye correction that Professor Lamoureux worked out. But the fact that we're working with this semiconductor germanium, there is some kind of screening when you apply some voltages. So there is a little bit of correction, but it's not very much. But as of now, maybe the theoretical prediction is insufficient due to the fact that I don't have a complete optical data, but our data seem to agree neither of the theories. And we have this clear 1/D-like forces at large distances. And this has to be understood. This is something else. And what's next? Yeah.
Clearly you have a 1/D at large distances. That's the deviation that you're talking about.
Right here. So if I fit this data over here, I get 1.1, 1.2, something like that as an exponent. But as I said, I don't think there isn't any measurements that started at such a large distance, around 100 micron. Usually below 1 micron, that's the typical distance regime that you're looking at when you do a Casimir force measurement.
You don't give the error bars measurements.
Oh, yes. So, sorry. So, yeah, that's because I gave plenty of statistics there. Actually, that's a good point because... So I'm just taking the binned averages here. So the error bar will come from some kind of standard deviation. It will depend on how I bin my experimental data. So I should have shown this the entire data points because it's so tricky how the way you bin your data, it could have a slightly different error bar. And I don't want to mislead with my different error bars. So, but these are the actual. But these are the actual data. Probably you can probably guess. You can have a pretty reasonable guess of error bar, given this scattering here. Yeah, I could have put my error bar based on the standard deviation, but. Did you have?
But your error bars seem to be more or less the same independent of distance, isn't it?
So remember I had a 60-100 points, and here I have only 60 data points, so it's an average of 100 blocks of data points. So I don't know. I mean, it should be comparable to the scattering that you see over here. The error bar. But sorry, I didn't put that. I should have done that. But I mean, I think it's clear from the whole data, raw data measurements, that it should be reasonable to the scattering of the data here.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can discuss it. I have that all available. So this is the data fresh off the oven. No correction applied, no residual volts, because we don't have a clear model, clear theoretical model to apply this contact potential changes and translate that into the actual data points. But these are the pure data points that we get from our problem measurements, which we are confident. Okay? So once you know these contact potential measurements or minimizing potential measurements, you can also apply your own the correction on the force signals here and see how that compares with the theory. But for now, there is a clear deviation from the actual theoretical prediction. Okay? So these are the data.
Why did you use the germanium? I mean, why not the metal?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because when Steve started these measurements, it was for us it was clear that the metallic plates have been well understood. There was all this claim about 1% precision of the Casimir force measurements. And we wanted to move on to next level where we really looking at this semiconductor, the force between the semiconductor, germanium, and also see how the Lipschitz formula could agree with it, with our data measurements.
Well, but the metallic case is not understood at all.
Well, at that point, yeah, I mean, I understand. I think
now you know.
Because I think it would be very useful to go back to metallic plates and do the same experiment, apply the same experiment to procedure and see what kind of data we get. Because without this kind of
manual, you may have lots of, a contribution from spatial dispersion.
Sure, sure.
It's more complicated.
Yeah, but my hunch is that even with the metallic plates, there is this reports that the contact potential do changes.
Yeah, yeah.
So you will experience something very similar. And I think when Steve came to Yale and when he was setting up this, at that time I probably, there was all these measurements with, very good precision, accuracy, and
to resolve the controversy.
Yes, <Sure. laughs> I agree. All right, so any force measurement should confirm and provide measurements of contact potentials with distance when reporting the force distance curve. As you saw, it's crucial because there is this crucial correction factor arising due to the fact that the contact potential changes. And it's a very small effect, but that could change the entire picture of your interpretation. And if contact potentials are found to vary, the residual electric force due to that change must be taken into account. So let me give you some perspective on these whole measurements on the Casimir side. It all started from Steve Lamoureux's 1997 measurements. And notice that all these contact potential measurements are pretty much constant. And it's varying. It has a wide...
The material here was...
Okay, so Lamoureux, he had a gold plate between sphere plane. Muhyiddin had a gold plate between sphere plate. Chen, that's a Capasso group, they also use the plate, sphere plane, gold. Deca group used copper plates, I believe. Copper and gold or something like that. Gold? Yeah. And then Onofria, which I was, Professor Onofria, with whom I was working for my thesis, we used the gold plates in a sphere plane geometry. And there we noticed the contact potential do change with respect to distance. And as I came to the Lamoureux group, I did the same measurements and was changing. And notice that we have this 100 micron, which is unprecedented in terms of the distance exploration. Most of these measurements start from a few micron down to tens of nanometer. But we started at 100 micron. And notice that our radius of curvature is very big compared to other measurements here. So I'll give you some kind of historical surveys about how these old measurements were conducted. We are all the same family of this Maxwell's equation and the Russian schools where we have all this molecular force computation based on Lipschitz theory and etc. So from the experimental point of view, we have a very good measurement, an early attempt. To understand these measurements in 1950s to 1980s. It's just one nice tree. But then there was an invention of atomic force microscope starting 1986. And there is some kind of deviation, some kind of dichotomy in the field, in a sense that you have on one side AFM, using AFM, you do a bunch of force measurements, force distance measurements. And these community really don't communicate with the Casimir force measurements, which has reportedly started from Lamoureux's 1997 paper, and etc. But the problem is there is a lack of communication between the two community. Although, as I said, we are looking at this very general idea, general studies of the molecular force, starting from the Lebedev's original statement about this molecular vibrator. So there is numerous AFM force measurements, both molecular van der Waals force type, but there is never really close talk between the two communities. On this note, I would like to make a first announcement. There is a non-contact AFM conference at Yale next year. On part of that, I'm organizing with Steve Lamoureux a Casimir Force workshop. And this is to bring these two communities together and really tackle these various issues about the measurement procedures. Okay? So conclusion. Casimir force can be understood in terms of macroscopic van der Waals force due to radiation processes of randomly fluctuating sources. This is probably my own opinion, but you may take a different views on the Casimir force. We have presented a detailed experimental procedure to measure the Casimir force by taking into account the varying contact potential. For any precision force measurement, this must be done. It will be extremely useful to reperform the same measurement in a pair of metallic plates, since previous measurements have not accounted for the residual force arising from varying contact potential. Both the Casimir and AFM community should work together to tackle this important issue arising from residual electric effects. It seems premature to claim any new physics beyond the Casimir force at this point. As you saw. For anyone interested in understanding the slow variation of 1 over D-like force in our data, you're more than welcome to discuss with us. I would like to just deviate slightly from my discussion, which is I want to focus on this inverse square law. Notice that for our electrostatic measurements, we had to rely on this 1 over D of the Coulomb's law. And depending on the apparatus type and sample geometry, one might have to deal with a higher power load. For instance, in my Dartmouth experiments, I was looking at the frequency shift between a plate and a sphere. Okay? So when you're looking at the frequency shift, you're looking at the gradient of the force. So the force law, 1 over d, becomes 1 over d squared, for instance. Okay? And all precision measurements crucially depends on the validity of the above power law required for the system calibration, and yet no direct bona fide measurements, force distance measurements for the inverse square law since the Coulomb's original experiment in 18th century. So notice that we always want to get a precise and accurate values of van der Waals force, Casimir force type. In doing so, you're always looking at the power law dependence. But none of these measurements are really, really crucially really looking at this Coulomb's original measurements, because it's basically you're looking at the same power law, and this power law has to hold in order for you to validate your analysis. So any measurements should really confirm as a first step if you want to do a precision measurement whether your calibration is robust enough to hold this Coulomb's inverse square law. And I wrote, so with the Professor Onofuria, we wrote a little paper discussing these issues, and we noticed that the 1 over d squared in our case, because we were looking at the gradient of the force, we noticed that it's not exactly 1 over d squared, but it was in fact the 1 over, the exponent was 1.8 or 1.7. It was slightly different from the usual expectation. So this is why I'm bringing up these issues, because it's very crucial. You want to do precision measurements, your calibration, which relies on this 1 over D or some kind of power, has to be robust. So here's the Lamoureux group and students, postdocs, and special thanks to Thurston, Amy, everyone here for invitation. Thank you.
The other way, pay attention to the material in the first place. Now that you see the problems, what would be the best materials if you had your life to live over again? Starting with germanium, which is horribly interesting.
I would just start with the gold plates again. Yeah. I mean, that's a must.
Why it wasn't your first choice?
No, that's. I mean, I didn't know about all this. I mean, I was not confident enough that how this contact potential could vary with distance. I mean, my previous measurements had to suffer a lot of noise and systematic errors, so I wasn't sure at that point. And when I moved to Yale, the setup was already there for germanium measurements. And
so if you go, say, to 10-15 microns, model plasma model gives, say, top A for the force. Drew the model A over 2. So it's enough to have, say, 50% accuracy to distinguish and to resolve this lasting controversy. No? I wonder really why.
But I think
we have to go to 100 microns.
Yeah, we don't have to.
10, 12, even less in fact.
But from experimental perspective, it's crucial to go that far because you want to make sure that you have a good DC value of your signal. In our case, it's a PID signal. The PID could have some different value at a shorter distance, so it's better to just stretch as far as possible.
Does this problem with the calibration, the dependence of the contact potential on the distance, arise also in metallic systems?
Yes, there are a number of reports on that.
Also
on the metallic.
So for large separations, you said it's 1 over D. This is what you see from experiments. 500 to 5 nanometers.
That's a good point. Well, actually, it's I needed an extra parameter. Okay, let's actually go back. Can we just move this whole thing up? I can just write something quickly on the blackboard.
Yeah, just on the light and use the side.
Ah. So the electrostatic force between sphere and plane, we have a 1 over D here. And then when I fit, I need some experimental parameters. So basically, this is our K value, the curvature, parabola curvature. And I should have an extra parameters here as well. And then some F naught, which is the minima of the curve. Okay. So in order to find, in order to test the Coulomb's law, 1 over D dependence, I collect this K values from each distance. Okay. When I do a fitting, I need the alpha, which is a factor here, over D. And then I remember I had an additional parameter, which is the asymptotic limit of that Paolo, which is D naught. Okay. So alpha over D naught minus CR. That's the parameter I need. Notice that I needed two parameters here. Alpha, which gives me the calibration factor of the system, and D naught, which is the asymptotic limit. Well, in reality, this has to be clearly 1 over D. The exponent should be 1. But when I fit our experimental values using this formula, I get something larger than 1. So for instance, I get 1.1. And it was necessary for me to fit this data with an additional parameter, K naught. Okay? And alpha over D naught minus DR. And this is some offset parameter of the Paolo that I'm trying to fit with. And when I included this extra parameter, your exponent was slightly less than 1. So when I had this formula, which should be correct, which shouldn't carry any other parameters, I get something larger. But when I included that additional offset parameter, I get something less. So the exponent that I reported, 0.9979, is some kind of average between these two procedures.
And then when you move further in, what kind of exponent do you see there?
Oh, that's a good question. That's something we should actually test. And we actually tested at a large distance, from 500 micron down to 100 micron, and it was not clearly one at all at that regime. But from 100 micron down to 500 nanometer, given that we took this kind of averages, it's a very good agreement with the 1 over D. But that good agreement is coming from this extra ad hoc parameter that I had to put in order to have a good chi-square. Yes?
So, but wouldn't it greatly help to be able to exactly measure the capacitance at each point by, sending these AC, putting an AC voltage and then measuring impedance or whatever it's called?
And how would that help to understand this?
Because isn't this prefactor and the other one exactly the...
Yeah, so this is basically 1/2 C prime, right? Yeah.
Right, so if you could independently measure that...
Yeah, and we actually did. Uh-huh. And the only information we can get is, of course, when you do a capacitance measurement, you also get some kind of similar asymptotic limit because it's increasing as you get closer. So we can confirm this absolute distance assessment of our system. You always get something like between 500 nanometer down to 400 nanometer with a capacitance measurement as well. But other than that, it doesn't really help to understand the contact potential measurements here. And also it doesn't really help to figure out what's the calibration factor. We have to use this formula in order to understand both calibration factor and the absolute distance. But this could give us some kind of confirmation on the absolute distance. And it will be interesting to look at the chi-square, or because to see the capacitance between the sphere plane is actually logarithmic. And when you take a derivative, you get 1 over d, and that's why you have 1 over d here. But it will be interesting to see how closely it resembles that logarithmic fit as well. But we do have that measurement using relaxation oscillator, and we did confirm the distance measurements and various things. But we feel that this formalism, fitting procedure has to be done, and the capacitance measurements may give us some confirmation, but it's not very crucial at this point.
Can I just ask about the Coulomb law? I mean, you know Coulomb law, right? You can do Rutherford scattering right way down to small distances. So if you don't see the Coulomb law, what conclusion do you come to?
If I don't see the Coulomb
law? But you said you had the 1 over D.
Yeah, so with these extra parameters, I actually saved the Coulomb's law because the average between these two fitting procedures gave me, very good 1 over D law. But other than that, if I just take one procedure independently, then I get something larger or something smaller. It's not exactly one at all. And notice that, the Coulomb measurements, mostly it's you're testing the Coulomb's inverse scale law by doing a null test. You're looking at the Gauss's law and see if there is any residual electric field in a spherical surface. But if you wanna do this kind of precision measurements, this Coulomb's law also has to be conducted with the same similar procedure to looking at the exact power law. Otherwise, any claim for precision measurements on the residual signal could be invalid, because for a given system, you could have a different power law. And if you have a different power law, your calibration factor and then absolute distance give you the different values.
But could you not deduce, Coulomb law, as mentioned, you can go to Rydberg atoms, they have microscopic extension, and you could, you have atoms have an RZ radius of micrometer range, right?
But I don't think you can have as controllable experiment as this kind of measurement with the Rydberg atoms. With the Rydberg atoms, basically you're looking at... So how do you measure the force with the Rydberg atoms? You're looking at some kind of frequency shift?
No, you can probably measure the radius, isn't it? Good enough.
I'm not quite sure, because... I mean, there is some kind of Casimir force measurement using ultra-cold atoms by Eric Cornell.
You do not measure the force, but you measure the radius.
With the Rydberg? But I mean, Coulomb's force, it's a very simple idea. You take two charges and they attract each other. So force distance curve, that's the most direct measurement you can do. If that doesn't hold true in your measurements, then you have to stop because you can't do any more.
Maybe the operator part of your sentence is not charge and force, but hold. Maybe just there's some other stuff going on besides the idealization.
Because in Coulomb's original...
Does anyone here clearly have any worries about Coulomb's law? I'm just curious.
I worry. Because if in Coulomb's original experiments, there are only three data points, force versus distance.
Tons of data since then.
There's elementary particle physics that verify Coulomb's law. G minus 2, which is not exactly Coulomb's law, is from thermodynamics, it's down to 8 decimal places.
I don't know. Whatever it is, I mean, it's a simple measurement, and something has to be done in order to clearly see what's going on. But this is what I get from my measurements, and I had to work around in order to claim 1 over D. As you saw, I had to have this extra parameter.
So are you claiming that there might be, so Coulomb law would be good at the atomic scale, because otherwise the whole quantum mechanics collapses. So you're saying that there is perhaps an intermediate range of distance,
but you can
larger than atomic scale. Now it claims that I can have huge atoms. So again, I can probe it accurately.
But I have not worked with any atomic physics to measure the Coulomb's force. I don't know how it's done, but when I look at Coulomb's force, I mean, it's a simple idea. You just take two charged particles and see how their force changes with respect to distance. And this is exactly what we do in the Casimir force measurements, force versus distance. And I mean, I can't think of any other simple experiments than this.
But you have to have everything else under control, right? I mean, from the size of the object and things like
that. Oh, sure. But what my thing is that my point is that you cannot take it for granted. You do have to go back, make sure your exponent does obey the Coulomb's law. Otherwise, your calibration is not valid.
You know, before talking about such things, you are using a real material, you know, germanium.
Right.
The optical properties of germanium depend on things like doping, like all sorts of dirt, surface states. Now you use the Palik results, which are done on one type of germanium. You have another type of germanium.
Sure, sure.
The doping is probably not exactly the same.
Sure,
you quoted the resistance. The resistance depends on the doping.
So
I think you have more uncertainties than I would believe there are uncertainties on the Coulomb law.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. Yeah. I'm just saying, and as a part of the experimental procedure, this is a step that you have to go through because that's so fundamental. It's a calibration that sets the basis of your entire analysis.
Yeah,